Greetings and salutations. This is AC2GS. Roy here with the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on since 1982 in one form or another, mostly under the guidance and headmastership of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key last year. So in memory of his achievements of so many years, we continue the Technical Net. And this is Sunday night. It is also Happy Pi Day to people who realize that it's 3.14.21, which is as close to Pi as we get each year. And welcome to the first Eastern Daylight Savings Time edition of this year's Technical Net. So let me drop for a second and I'll add the usual stuff. Tony Doak. As always, if you can't get onto the radio, if you can't get through Echolink, if you can't get through IRLP, there are other venues. Tell us with either questions or topics or puzzles. We always like puzzles. Or if you see something space-related and you'd like to get Paul, WS2N's opinion on the subject, the email address to reach us is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There are links available every single week. If I don't get to the Science Talk segment articles, I post them, and they're interesting to read. And if I find other things that are more visual, that don't lend themselves too much to radio conversations, I will post them as well, and they're available for you to peruse at your leisure throughout the week, although they remain there forever and ever, just like everything on the Internet. And you can get to that by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and it will take you to my link page. Again, it's roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. You can go to Limark's website and find the link to the chat room, or you could just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. There's an audio stream. I stream this on the Internet so that if people don't have a radio, they can still access the audio stream. So tell your friends who are interested to just to type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the W2VL repeater feed. I keep it alive as best I can, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And I always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has done a great job in archiving the Technical Nets as far back as September 2006. He has them available on his website, which is amateurradio.tv. So please avail yourself of it. Let me drop for a second. Okay, our plan tonight is very, very similar to our plans previous Sunday night. I will ask people if they have any questions or topics of a technical nature for the TechNet. I will write down their first name and their call sign, and we will try to address each question or topic in order. Somewhere between 8:30 and 8:45, I will introduce Andy, WA2CDL, for his next episode of Andy's Corner, which I'm looking forward to. He's going to be talking about Hertz antennas. And then when he's done, I will come back and finish up the questions, ask if there are any other questions, maybe offer you a couple of puzzles for you to ponder. And if time allows, maybe tell you a couple of Science Talk stories that I have pruned from the Internet. Then around 10:15 or so, I will introduce Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. That'll take us to about 11 o'clock when I'll come back, tie a bow on, tell you that we'll see you again next week. So that's the plan. I hope to approximate it as best we can tonight. So I will start by asking if anyone has any technical questions or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please to hit that push-to-talk button and give me your call sign and your first name.
Roy, this is Wayne, KD2UDU, just with an update from last week.
Okay, Wayne, I'll put you down for an update. I'm looking forward. I'm hoping that it's good news. Anyone else out there have any technical questions or topics for tonight? We seem to have a free night here, so please, if you got something, hit that push-to-talk button and share it with us. Oh, well, maybe some people will shuffle in a little bit late and have some questions. So, Wayne, how's the situation with the radio? I hope it's better.
Yeah, I met with Andy, and, you know, we went through it. Mainly Andy went through it. I stood by and tried to help as much as I can. We did not blow any more fuses, and it seemed a lot better than I thought. I had feared that I had blown my main transformer on the power supply. So as far as I know, Andy is still working on it. He found a switch that he felt that was the probable cause of some of the problems. And it looks like it is on the mend.
Okay, very good. So it didn't turn out to be a short in the transformer. Do you know offhand if it was the capacitors or something completely unrelated?
Don't know. You know, so we're completely done. Andy continued to work on it. You know, I had some control. But he had tested the capacitors, and he didn't feel that they were, you know, shorted out. We didn't find any shorts anywhere, honestly. And we also went through the power cord that I had. It was long, but then Andy called me and said, no, you did do it correct. So the power cord has been eliminated from the probable cause. So, I mean, it's still a work in progress, but I have a lot more hope than I did initially, because, like I said, I thought I had a longer transformer.
Okay, good to hear. I hope that you get it fully functional. It sounds like things are on the right track, and Andy is certainly the guy to help you out. He has a great skill and a great mind, and can apply himself to just about any piece of electrical equipment that I know of. So you're in good hands, and things looking good. So I hope that you'll be able to use it soon. And once again, I hope you'll try and reach us on the 10-meter net.
You know, Roy, I'm sorry, I missed out on that. What was the frequency again and the time that you normally need on 10 meters?
We're there every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. We're on 28.380 upper sideband.
8, 3, 8. All right, I'll definitely make a point of trying to tune in next Sunday. I mean, this Sunday I was barely awake because of the time change. I'm really a night owl now because I've switched my hours to evening. So I wind up sleeping later in the morning. It takes longer for me to get going then.
Okay, so, you know, whenever you're ready for us, so we've been going on for at least 10 plus years. I don't recall who started it and how far back it went. We're waiting for you, so when you get a chance, someday on a Sunday at 11 a.m., twirl up to 28.380 and take a listen. We seem to have some kind of weird force field between Queens and Nassau County. We get very few, basically one person has been able to breach that force field. Otherwise, we hear as far down as Florida, down south. But up north, for some strange reason, past Queens, we got lots of problems. So don't know if we'll hear you, but give it a try, and who knows?
Yeah, I will definitely be there next Sunday. Thank you, Roy.
52 Bravo Zulu. Yes, Reg.
I haven't heard your signal this quiet in a year. Did they do anything to repeat it?
No, you're listening to me once again through Plainview, not really directly through Glen Oaks. I went on about an hour or two ago and tried at full power and was still rather noisy, and Lou was hearing my attempts and understood and came back and told me that he would enable the UHF link. So thanks to Lou and Plainview. You're listening to me. Otherwise, it would be a...
Absolutely voiceless. And I haven't heard that since the days of Eric, a long time ago. The question I want to ask is, you know, earlier we were talking privately about what's happening on digital radio and how all of a sudden there are a lot of dropouts. You're in the middle of a sentence and you just drop out. And it's happening more and more and more, and I'm just wondering if anybody else knows what's going on, if anybody's into that world, that could sort of say, the network is way too overloaded, or whatever it is, because it's getting a little unusable, let me put it that way. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll throw it out to the audience. I don't know how many of the people out there are aficionados of hotspot internet, the voice over internet protocol, digital mode networking. I would tend to disagree, as usual, with your friend David. There's a little bit inside baseball because we talk using all kinds of different modes, and we had a short conversation on DMR as well as over the phone recently. I don't think it's just general internet overhead, simply because the audio stream is the least likely to be problematic. You know, if we were doing something like a Zoom or such, where we were feeding a video and audio, yeah, that can clog things rather quickly. I think most of it is simply the overhead of the server use. You know, if you find a server that's barely used, perhaps, or state-of-the-art, or a high-end design, it probably would be a better experience. But I tend to think that it's primarily the servers. Brandmeister is the server that we used earlier. It's there's 100 or 200 different servers. They're patched to different versions. They have different types of connections, I would assume, and they have to interact with each other, which is a certain amount of overhead. So I would kind of think that it's more server-based than it is individual and or the internet getting clogged. If the internet can provide millions of Netflix streams of 4K, I think it can handle an audio stream. But I'd be interested if anyone out there is familiar with Brandmeister, DMR, servers, and the talk groups, if they have any thoughts on why there's a tendency for audio to drop out when you're in a talk group stream. I'd love to hear it.
The internet is a big pipe. You know, I don't know if they've gone beyond three, but the internet is a big pipe. And I guess it's just Brandmeister's network. If what you're saying is it's Brandmeister's network, most likely, that can't handle the traffic. And not meters, but the actual servers that are just privately owned servers that are getting overwhelmed with this amount of traffic. Is that what you're saying, Mark?
AC2GS. Yeah, that's my feeling of it. Again, based not on exact numbers and knowing a great deal about the individual servers at work and their stats and such, but just generally how the internet works. I mean, there are enormously fat channels being spewed by commercial companies that stream video at high quality. So I mean, the amount of data that's passed back and forth, that's audio, is kind of minuscule by comparison. So I would think that all these other things that people are streaming would suffer enormously long before it would impact on an audio channel. I know your friend thinks that, but I would tend to disagree. It's kind of a very easy, quick answer to a question, but I don't think it makes a great deal of technological sense, personally.
I heard another station in there. I guess not. So what you're saying is there are internets and there are internets. And the people who are making the big bucks from the internet have one internet. And the guys like Grandmeister and WireZX and E-Star and TMR, they have another internet that's not quite as well-funded and therefore as robust. I guess that's what you're saying. But unfortunately, it is getting... There's a very rare QSO where a signal isn't dropped anymore, and it's getting to be a little bit of a pain in the butt. We may have to go all the way back to HF, whatever that is. Back to you, Roy.
Or you guys can set up your own server, and that makes life a little bit easier. What you're alluding to is something that was highly political in the last few years, called net neutrality. There is a differing of opinion whether commercial internet service providers can optimize packet transfer for services that they're interested in at the cost of services they're not interested in. And, you know, that was one of those things that, again, goes back to things like Netflix, because Netflix uses a lot of internet bits. And so there were ISPs out there saying that, you know, they're making a lot of money, and they're passing a lot of bits through shared networks that we maintain, so we would like some of their money. And if they would not like to give us their money, then we would like them to get the heck out of our shared network. And that in a nutshell, is net neutrality. Net neutrality was very popular until IJPI came in. IJPI was a guy who was basically a lobbyist for all these big companies, and so he thought it was peachy keen to hold out on Netflix and others for profit. And so I think he basically did away with most of the FCC guidelines for net neutrality. It hasn't, thankfully, had a dramatic effect. No company has basically thrown guys off their pipes. But the pendulum, I think, is going to swing in the opposite direction. It'll be interesting. I don't think it's net neutrality. I don't think it's that internet service providers are kicking packets off of their networks. I think it's more that the Brandmeister servers are not of the highest technical capability and might be reaching a certain limitation of they're very popular, they're used a lot, and I think they're being banged on a little too much. So they're either going to have to build it up a little bit more, with more servers or more powerful servers. So you might want to send a pleasant letter to Brandmeister and ask them if they're planning to kind of decompress the network by introducing a bunch of new servers, hint, hint. Always being polite.
Is there anything in technology like codecs that can read for bandwidth out of these signals, or is that not possible?
Well, not really, because it's already compressed. So if you add another layer of compression, you end up with a bigger file. If you take a zip or a rare and then run it through rare again to re-rare it, you'll find that, unfortunately, the resultant file gets larger, not smaller. It's already going through the AMBI voice encoder decoder chipset, which is the only one really in town. There is a non-profit in the public arena a voice encoding decoding algorithm. It's probably no more efficient than AMBI's, and AMBI wants to make money off of their technology, so they're going to do whatever they can to have people not promote it, but I don't think it would squeeze anything. Again, you're talking about little teeny itsy-bitsy bandwidth. I mean, a 4K video transmission is incredibly bigger, even compressed, than any audio stream, any badly, poorly compressed audio stream. So a codec modification shouldn't really affect the situation in the slightest.
I was talking to two women last night in North Carolina who had just gotten their tickets, and they were telling me that there are at least 60 or 70 fans in their area, and half of them are recent hands and got into it because of digital. So I think it's the future of the hobby. You know, the rest of us are old and gray and hunched over and crawling on the floor and eating tablets and stuff like that. And, so I hope that the technology can keep up with the traffic that seems to be flooding in, or the interest that's flooding in to digital ham radio, because I think people are finding that it's the quality of the QSO that matters, not how the signal got from one place to another, but it's what's talked about when it gets there. That's my philosophy anyway. Back to you, Roy.
Well, there are a lot of hams out there with a lot of differing philosophies. Some of them have clipboards and a checklist, and if we don't meet the checklist, then we're not really hams. I mean, one of my shining moments, I think it was about 2 months into this hobby, could have been a little bit less, and a old-timer told me that I was what's bad about the new group of hams joining the fraternity, and I considered it a sign that I was doing just the right thing. He was a very little-minded little man, but I talk about this repeatedly, and probably bore some people, that the depth and the breadth of this hobby is what I find the most amazing. You can go off into little nooks and crannies and get lost there and have loads of fun for 40-odd years and never look back. But, you know, you could touch on a lot of them, and then it'll take a lot of time. Digital's nice. I like digital. I don't love digital. I am more interested with the underlying technology behind digital, because that's kind of what I look at. I don't mind having a good conversation. That's why I'm sitting here tonight having a good conversation with you and others who will join us later on. But the technology is what impresses me, and I appreciate the technology. It's not that different, DMR, than D-Star, which is not that much different than Fusion, although guys live and die by those particular modes, and they swear up and down that the sound is better, and it's much easier to tolerate, and all kinds of things, and they hate the other ones because they sound robotic and what have you. I mean, Eric, unfortunately, had a hearing problem, so he had a distorted spectral ability to hear, and some of the digital modes, when they reproduce the voice, really annoyed the heck out of him because of his being able to be limited to certain frequency ranges that most of us have a broader recognition for. But you know, different shows for different folks. It's my general belief that the overwhelming majority of large numbers of Americans who've gotten their technical license are more for sort of emergency purposes, prepping, having a backup frequency either for emergencies or, in one case, a guy told me mountaineering, or other reasons. I'm not quite sure if a lot of people outside of the hobby even know what digital modes mean.
That's too bad, because it is a lot of fun. It really is to have a round table with somebody in Guam and San Francisco and Philadelphia. I mean, that's a lot of fun, just to get to know people around the world without having to fight propagation, you know, QRM and QRM. It's a lot of fun. I've met a bunch of really good people on all of them, DMR, and I couldn't tell you which one is which, whether it's DMR or D-Star or WireX. I couldn't tell you. Maybe it's because of my lack of good hearing, but I couldn't tell you which one is which. They all sound heck of a lot better than HF to me. Anyway, thanks, Roy. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Rich, anytime. And, you can't really compare the digital modes to single sideband. I would imagine that the most legitimate comparison would be more of FM repeaters and such. And just, you know, FM repeaters are capable of doing that to an extent as well. We are IRLP enabled. It's through IRLP that I'm linked from the UHF to the VHF repeaters. And every so often, thankfully, John KC2SHO from Los Alamos joins us by linking in. We have a Canadian repeater that links us every 8:30 to 10:30. And so theoretically, we can be linked to other repeaters by voice over internet protocol, IRLP, all over the world and have the same type of conversations. I mean, you could have interesting conversations with people in the Philippines and Australia and New Zealand and all over the place, or you can discuss the weather and what they had for lunch. I've heard both. So location isn't inherent in the interesting nature of the conversation. It's ultimately important, the people and the minds connected to the people that, to me, make a big difference between a vaguely interesting QSO and a intriguing QSO.
And I live in an HOA, can't put up an antenna, propagation isn't good. What would I do otherwise, you know, try to get... So, in terms of that, in terms of hands not being able to operate unless they have these digital modes, and the cost of entry is so small. I mean, it's $200. I have it as Anytone, VHF, UHF, and FM band radio, both digital and analog. It's amazing for the price. It's just amazing for the price. You know, where else would I be? I sure would be talking, well, I could be talking to you guys, but that's about it. I may hit shells in, and that's about it. That was in my hammer. And now I made some friends with some mechanics in North Carolina, and I need mechanics to help give me some advice about my car. So, anyway, once again, thanks a lot. Please, please.
You're welcome, Rich, and like I said before, if it works for you, have loads of fun with it. That's to me the ultimate point of this hobby. If you're having fun with it, it's a successful hobby. If you're not having fun, I wonder why anyone would waste their time doing something that they hate doing. And I think, as I mentioned to you, and I probably mentioned on the TechNet, there was a time that I was listening to kind of the most active of Brandmeister channels, which is Talk Group 91. That's called Worldwide English. It's everyone who can speak English in one channel. And the overwhelming conversation seems to be very, very nice gentlemen of a certain maturity whose grandchild had popped in with either a MD-380 or an Anytone 878 or 868 and a Pi-Star hotspot, set it up for them, and they were trying it out for the first time. One of the problems with digital, again, we've discussed this before, is there's a little bit of a technological speed bump. It's not a big one, but it is not radio technology based. It is more commercial radio code plug writing and mildly software based of being able to set up your Raspberry Pi into your Pi Star correctly and get all the numbers and frequencies right. But once you do that, and I've offered code plugs in the past to people out there, and a few people have asked for help in getting their dongles that worked as hotspots to work, and we've been able to help them get over that little speed bump. But it is a speed bump for many of us, unfortunately. Okay, thank you, Rich, for your participation as well. It's already 8:33. It's probably a good time to summon Andy from Andy's Corner and give us this week's segment, which will include Hertz antennas. I'm looking forward to it. Andy?
Oh. Am I on? Oh, yes, I am. Okay. Very good. Good evening, everyone. This is Andy's Corner on the tech debt. Get myself a little bit more organized right now. And Roy, you sound fine through the link. Okay. So, I've heard Wayne before. Hello to you again, Wayne. And good to see you today. So I made a little mistake. Because we were talking in the past about different antennas, and I'm going through this, and I'm saying, wait a minute, I thought we discussed Hertz antennas, which is another name for a dipole. And this was actually under the antenna fundamental section that I've been talking about. So what I meant to say, it's not the Hertz antenna, but it's the Marconi antenna. Of course, We refer to a Hertz antenna as a dipole. Well, we call it a dipole, but it's also called a Hertz antenna, and we spoke about dipoles. What we did not speak about was the Marconi antenna. And now that I'm looking through my notes here, and I see the Marconi is a vertical antenna, as opposed to a dipole antenna, which could be either strung vertically or horizontally. So this little segment, and I apologize for all the illustrations because they show here. It's really hard to convey illustrations to people. It's better just to read, unless you have a good sense of closing your eyes and visualizing what I'm talking about, which I even have trouble doing. But we'll try to muddle our way through it and see what information we could pass on to you guys out there in case you want to play around with this stuff. There's so many. I just got a bunch of QSTs, back issues of QSTs from one of my friends, and because I don't have a subscription to QSTs, there's always stuff on the antennas. I mean, there's always articles on building all different types of helically wound antennas using this copper tape or. You know, using PVC or whatever materials you can get. And you can build your own antennas, and it's pretty cheap. It's not expensive to do. And there's plenty of formulas out there and software programs, EasyNIC and all the others, a lot of stuff. So, again, this is just an overview of what's out there so you guys can get an idea. What these antennas do, and basically, you know, they're designed. Alright, so this is a relatively short article on the Marconi antenna. Okay, and then what I'll do is I'll talk about, and this is more talk than anything else. Antenna power and radiated field strength measurements. I'm sure most of you out there have heard of what is known as a field strength meter. And actually, field strength is measured in microvolts per meter, or millivolts per meter, and however it's calibrated. And it's used to, basically, for a number of reasons. One, it would be to find the directional pattern of an antenna. Also to get a relative, because those are usually relative, it's not a direct reading. Field strength is usually, you know, it's indirect. You're not connecting it to anything, you're just picking up a signal. And could be used as an indicator of how much power you're putting out to your antenna, you know, as a reference. You set it up to a certain level, and then you see if there's any change over time. So, many different functions of the field strength meter itself. So, we can talk a little bit about that. Okay, so the little discussion I'll give you guys on the Marconi antenna is this. By the way, this is Andy's Corner. If you're just tuning in, that's this portion of the technical match, which is run by Roy, AC2GS. He's been doing it now for quite some time, and he's doing a very good job of doing that. So thank you, Roy, for keeping this net going and all the people that are listening to it. All right, so the Marconi antenna. See, this is a grounded quarter-wave vertical antenna, as shown in the figure. Talk about figures. So it's a vertical antenna, and the interesting thing is the position of the image is such that the action of the antenna is equivalent to that of a half-wave antenna. So I'll just repeat that. So basically, a vertical antenna is a quarter wavelength. A dipole is a half wavelength, as we discussed, but the vertical section is a quarter wavelength. There is an image, which is, you could look at that as below the ground, and that makes up the other quarter wave. So they show this image in a picture. So, because it's a quarter wavelength rather than a half wave, it says here, because it's a quarter wave, and because of the action of the antenna's image, you know, it is equivalent to a half-wave length antenna, even though the actual physical length of the vertical element is a quarter-wave length long. Because of that, the terminal impedance is approximately 36 ohms, or half of that presented by a dipole. You remember we mentioned that a dipole in free space has a basic set of point, you know, feed impedance of about 72 ohms. This is half of that, exactly half, because it's a quarter wave rather than a half wave. So now the actual impedance is lower, you know, of course. So it says here, likewise, the vertical radiation pattern is exactly one half the vertical plane pattern of a free space dipole. Okay, so now they're referring to the Hertz antenna, which is a dipole. So it says, note that the Hertz antenna is basically a half wavelength long, while the basic Marconi type is a quarter wavelength long. And the Marconi has one end grounded. A dipole is not grounded at either end. A quarter wave of Marconi antenna is grounded on one end. All right, so the radiation pattern of the quarter wave Marconi antenna is not ideal for broadcast services. Although much of the energy is concentrated along the ground surface, a substantial amount of radiation is directed skyward, representing lost power. When the antenna height is increased to more than a quarter wavelength long, the radiation pattern is improved. So what they're basically saying is that the broadcast band, your angle of radiation is basically up towards the sky. And you do have ground wave radiation as well. You don't want your antenna, you don't want both your signal go to the sky, because who's up in the sky? You want it to go out to the horizon. But, you know, we hams do use vertical antennas, especially on cars. And on a car, it has an advantage. You could put a horizontal antenna on a car, but I don't know too many people who do. Most antennas on vehicles are vertical, vertically polarized. So they show you a diagram. Again, to try to convey diagrams as hard. It demonstrates the influence of the height of the Marconi antenna on the vertical radiation pattern and current distribution. Okay, basically, you know, showing the right side of the pattern, the left side would be the same. So, let me just read this a second so I can see if I can explain it better. There are three lengths of your vertical radiator. One being a quarter wavelength long, one being less than a quarter wave, and one being more than a quarter wavelength long. And depending on the length, will determine how you're going to feed it, how you're going to match it. You know, match it to your transmitter. And also, because of the different lengths of the vertical element, it'll show here, again, where the current is, the maximum current distribution at varying heights. In other words, the height the length of the antenna itself. So, again, and I'm just skimming the surface on this because you gotta see how the length of the antenna and how it causes the radiation pattern to change. That's the height above ground. But they show here, and it's really hard to see this. At least the writing is so small. They show sort of less than a They show less than a quarter wavelength and then a half wave, and then they go up to 0.65, which is not quite three-quarter wave, and they show a three-quarter wavelength antenna, and they just show how the higher that you go, the closer you get to one wavelength of the height, your main lobe from this antenna extends further out at a little bit of a higher elevation. Again, it's hard to explain it, but that's the best way to describe it. All right, so getting back to the reading here, because the illustrations are a little bit confusing. So it says here, they have shown only the right side of the pattern. The left side would be the same. The pattern shown in figure C is the most desirable one because it has the maximum ground radiation pattern and a minor sky wave lobe. Because you want maximum ground waves, you want the signal to stay away from the sky because there's nothing up there in the sky. So they're showing just the length of the antenna itself being the most, so the closer to a full wavelength antenna would be the most desirable. Alright, I jumped the gun before when I was talking about how to, you know, the feed port impedance, so I'll just mention that. So, as far as, you know, feeding it with a piece of coax, the Marconi antenna or vertical antenna is also current fed in a way similar to the way in which a dipole is fed. However, one side of the transmission line is at ground potential. You see, that's the thing. You see, a dipole antenna is a balanced antenna. You have the ground of your coax connected to one length, one wire of the dipole, and the hot semiconductor to the other line of the dipole. In this particular case, your shield or ground of the coax cable is connected to the ground. Or it's at ground potential. So, actually, the Marconi antenna is linked to ground through, and there's a coupling mechanism, which is basically a transformer that, you know, like a ballon, or in this case would be it wouldn't be a ballon, it would be an unbalanced transformer, or they usually call it UN, unbalanced to unbalanced, because it's not a balanced antenna. So they show this transformer as a way of coupling the coax cable to the end of the vertical antenna. So the electrical height of this antenna can be increased or decreased with, as far as impedance is concerned, with the use of loading coils. And it's a series loading coil or a capacitor. You can have a series capacitor or a series coil, depending on the length of the antenna, to match it from your feed line. And again, I'm just mentioning it because they're showing it in the picture here. So if it's exactly a quarter wave, then you just transform a couple it. If it's less than a quarter wave, then you add a loading coil to electrically increase its length. Series, you add a loading coil in series with the vertical radiator to match the impedance. And if it's more than a quarter wave, you know, because you want to tune out any reactances, you know, you want it to present a 50 ohm or whatever the impedance is of your transmitter or feed line. You want it. You don't want any reactants, you want a pure resistance load. So you feed it with a loading coil in series or a capacitor in series, depending on if it's either shorter than a quarter wave or longer than a quarter wave. Yeah, longer than a quarter wave means it's a longer length of wire, which has more inductance. Now you're going to add a capacitor to cancel out the reactants and make it a resistive load on the for that particular antenna. All right, so that's what it says basically about Marconi antennas. So, what you really have to know to summarize this whole thing is that the vertical antenna, as opposed to a Hertz antenna, which is a dipole. So Marconi's vertical, and it's got half the impedance. Instead of 72 ohms, it's got a low impedance, 36 ohm approximately. And the length of it will determine the major lobe that's emitted from it. And it basically works on a ground wave. You do have a lobe that will go up to the sky, a sky wave lobe, which you don't want. So, That's the whole point of a Marconi antenna, if you want to play with one of those. Okay, let me let it drop. Okay, that's the whole discussion on that right now. Now, the next chapter is basically on antenna power and radiated field strength measurements. So this we can just talk about a little bit, get into that as far as different ways of measuring antenna power, radiated field strength, and so on. So, in applying for a license to operate a broadcast station, the station operator must know the values of the carrier power output of the transmitter and the radiated field strength from the antenna at various points throughout the service area. The radiated field strength measurement is usually made only once when the antenna is first installed. If the height of the antenna or the transmitter power is changed, the FCC may require that the field strength measurement be made again. But I guess, we guys fool around with our power all the time. I know I do. But the FCC is not going to come knocking on my door finding out what's your field strength reading. But when it comes to a broadcast station, that's a different story, because they have to meet the strict requirements of what the FCC has. So there are two general methods of measuring the power output of a broadcast transmitter. One is called the direct method, and one is the indirect method. The direct method is used if the antenna current is measured, and the carrier power output is computed by using the formula P equals I squared R, which is, your basic power formula. By the way, it's very windy out. I'm hearing my garbage can floating all over the street, so there is some static on the repeater, which I am noticing. It's probably, to the wind. Alright, so when either the antenna resistance is not known, or there is no accurate means of measuring the antenna current, the indirect method can be used. The carrier output power is computed from the values of the power input to the final transmitter stage and the assumed operating efficiency. Yeah, basically, the efficiency factor is assigned by the FCC for different types of modulating methods and transmitter powers. So, it says let's study both methods of determining the carrier power output in a little more detail. So here, if you want to actually measure this, this is how they do the direct method way. The resistance value of the transmitting antenna is usually measured by consulting engineers responsible for the FCC approval of the original antenna installation and any modifications of it. The FCC does not specify any particular method to use in making the measurement. Any standard method is satisfactory, provided evidence is submitted as to the procedures used, the accuracy of the instruments, and the qualifications of the engineer conducting the measurements. Okay, so they will not give a detailed description of the methods for determining the antenna resistance, except to name three of the acceptable ones. These are the resistance variation method, the substitution method, and the bridge method. Okay, and again, this is how you measure it directly. So these are the three ways. So there's three ways of figuring this out. When the antenna's resistance is known, it is a simple matter to measure the current at the antenna input terminals and compare the carrier power output. To compute the carrier power output. Alright, I'll say this again because I got mixed up in the words. When the antenna resistance is known, it is a simple matter to measure the current at the antenna input terminals and compute the carrier power output. For example, suppose the current measured at the antenna input terminals is 7.5 amperes, and the antenna resistance is 72 ohms. The power input can be computed as follows. The P equals I squared R, and you got 7.5 squared times 72, which comes out to 4,050 watts. So it's simply a matter of, and the point is, if you know what the antenna resistance is, and you know what your current is, then you could figure out the wattage. And that's all there is to it. That's mainly the direct method. Of course, you're going to ask, you know, how do you measure antenna current? Well, they have antenna current meters. You could put an ammeter in series with the antenna, and you can actually measure the current that the antenna is seeing. I'm going to use the word drawing, if you want to say it that way. But you measure the antenna current with that kind of meter, an RF ammeter, which they do make, which is designed to measure that an RF current at that frequency, and you can measure the current, you know the resistance, you can figure out the power. Usually, the antenna current meter is read, and the meter reading is recorded periodically throughout the day. Okay, so this is just an FCC thing. Thus, the power measurement becomes a simple matter of reading a meter. Some stations, the voltage across the antenna terminal is read instead of the current to compute the power, and there's a different formula for that. And that is, because there's three power formulas, P equals E times I, E squared over R, or I squared R. And you could use your P equals E squared over R formula. And they're just mentioning that. So without confusing everyone, if you ever wanted to measure your transmit power, you can measure your current, you can measure your voltage, plug it into the formula, your power formula, and you got it. And that's what's known as the direct method. Most of us have watt meters, which we place in our shacks, and it just measures the wattage directly, which basically does the same thing. It's a watt meter because it measures current and voltage at the same time. It's got two pickups One measures current, one measures voltage, and it computes the power. And it does that for you. Automatically, rather than plugging into a formula and figuring it out. So you just buy a watt meter, put it in the line, and bingo, you know what your power is. All right, WATCDL, Andy's Corner. You know, I guess because of what's critical,